All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? All right, look, before I get into anything, I need to do some self-promoting. My new special, my stand-up special on Netflix, Too Real. That's what it's called. Premieres tomorrow, September 5th, on Netflix. You can go add it to your queue right now so you can stream it as soon as it's available. I'm very proud of this. It looks good. It's tight. It really is a good-looking special. Lynn Shelton did an amazing job with the direction. And all the people, I want to thank the people of Minneapolis again. But proud of it. So, yeah, tomorrow, Too Real, my new Netflix special, will be available. Dig it. Did I mention today on the show I have a comedy writer and comedian? He was more of a comedian back when I knew him. Now he's more of a comedy writer, Warren Hutcherson, who I started with, who I've been wanting to talk to for a while because he was really a funny guy. And I just hadn't, we had not talked in like probably 10, 15 years, 20 years. What's happening? Is it hot? Is it hot where you are? Is it hot and horrible? It's hot as fuck here. But it's weird in these end times to sometimes take a minute to just appreciate the relentlessness of the fucking weather. I'm a little weird. I enjoy a bit of desert heat sometimes, though it's a little bit much here. We're not quite in the desert, but LA is kind of a desert, but I kind of like it, man. I kind of like 104 degree temperatures because given that I don't do any drugs and I don't partake, there's something about that feeling of being baked. You walk outside and you're like immediately dehydrated and everything slows down. You can feel your heart slowing down. Sweat doesn't even have time to build up before it evaporates. And it's kind of, it's a bit mind altering. I don't know if anyone else feels the same way. A lot of people here, they complain about the heat constantly. It does get hot here during the summer months. I guess it has been a little relentless weather-wise. I guess really what I'm doing is kind of rationalizing the fact that every fucking day seems like either the beginning or the middle or maybe close to the end of the world ending. That's the way my brain puts it all together. Why not connect the dots? There's no reason not to connect the dots. You can connect the global warming dots. You can connect the nuclear Armageddon dots. You can connect the biblical end time dots. It's great that this president facilitates this portal to connect all the end time dots every day. Out here, the LA is partially on fire. That's the other thing. The fires are here. I'm not even sure how close they are to my house. They're kind of close, but I don't. There are people here in LA literally just going on their roofs to watch the city burn. They're watching it burn. I don't know if we're going to have to evacuate. I think it's still far off from here. I don't think, I don't know at this point how many homes have been swallowed by flames, but it's fire season in LA, and that's just something we've grown to accept. It's hot, and it's fire season. But that's the positive spin. The other spin is like, oh, this is it. The facilitator has arrived. Satan's minion has come, and the evangelicals are working with him. It's time to follow the instructions of the last book. Here it comes. We just need to clear that Temple Mount and get that ready for the rearrival of the Great One, and he will lift us all up right in time for the brush fires to just totally engulf Maron's house. That's actually in Revelations. We will be lifted off just in time for the brush fire to engulf Maron's house. Maybe I'm personalizing it. I don't know. Maybe. I got to look at it again. I haven't checked in with the cryptic poetry of the final chapter of the instruction book for how to get to heaven. But perhaps I shall. Maybe I'm not mentioned. I'm not trying to be morose, people. I'm not trying to be depressed. I'm trying to have a good time. I'm trying to sort of like not get hung up on dark futures or lack thereof and try to be in the present and enjoy myself. And, oh, I know what you're wondering. I know what you're asking yourself. Mark, how's it going without the nicotine? Did you fucking go back? Did you go back to it? Did you give in to the charm of the need and darkness and perverse, malignant desire that is compulsive addiction. Did you give in to it? Nope. Nope, I did not. I have not. I did not. I'm still a little itchy. Got the soul itch. Got the skin skeeves. But not too bad. Not too bad. It's more of a mental thing now. I guess it's been, what has it been, about a week? A solid week and a day. Maybe a week and a day. The physical need for caffeine and nicotine has passed. And I'm feeling better. My guts are working better. My brain feels better. My energy is better. If you call mania having more energy. Yeah, so right now I'm just kind of focusing on rebuilding my gut bugs. That's my new project. I'm doing a gut bug project. It's just that when you eat the nicotine, you drink all that caffeine. Caffeine's a diuretic. It also is a pooperetic. And the nicotine lozenges are made with one of the tols, the mannitols or the sorbitols, as a laxative effect to some degree. So your guts are kind of fucked up from both of those things. So I've been probioticking by eating kimchi and various krauts with the occasional probiotic shot of 450 billion acidophilus monsters. But then like now I'm kind of got this brain thing going on about my guts that Amanda, the lady who trains me, she told me that there's a prebiotic. So now like after I got off the nicotine, I just dumped a bunch of those good probiotic bacterial monsters into my guts because that's supposed to be healthy, but apparently they need to be fed, and what they like to be fed is cooked yams that aren't hot and jicama and some asparagus. So I've been focusing on feeding the new bugs in my intestines the stuff they like, and that's how I'm occupying my time post nicotine. Just concerned about the kind of living environment of my insides. That's the new project. My gut bugs feel good. And apparently if you got your gut bugs in check, the rest of it falls into place. That's the theory. That's the theory. I don't know. Warren Hutcherson is here. We talked for a bit. I haven't seen him in a long time. He used to have this great jokes about his dad and about being black and about things. I always had a lot of respect from his comic, and I know he went on to write be on the writing staff of the Bernie Mac show and other stuff. And I don't know, things just came around and we were able to make it happen. I talked to I think his wife reached out to me and I emailed her and then she contacted him. Yeah. I mean, in the house, I mean, I think just down the hall, but nonetheless, let's talk to Warren Hutcherson now about stuff. So Warren, like, I don't think I've seen you in a decade. Is that possible?
I think it's maybe two more decades. When you think about it,
maybe we ran into each other here or there quick, you know, like once or twice,
right?
But back in the day, I see you all the time.
Yeah,
it's weird. Yeah. I've known you a long time. Always liked you. I always liked your stand-up, and I remember at some point you were one of the first guys that I realized, like, well, I guess he's just writing now.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, you know, like, like, you know, you, I used to love the bits, and then all of a sudden it's like, Warren got a job writing, and I'm like, oh, is that something we can do? Because I don't want to do that.
Don't blame you. No, you know what? Because, and I think this is the thing that you realize either... You are committing the slowest suicide in the world.
Yeah.
Or you found the other way. You found like, you know what? I was working too hard at something else, and now I got this. But I know now, and part of me even being here, part of me when I said,
I think it's a practical decision. I'm not condescending it at all.
No, it's. But that's the thing. That's the slow suicide of it.
Right.
Once you decide, I think, this is my philosophy.
Right.
Once you decide to do stand-up, and once you do it, and then you become, like, good at it, and you start thinking, I think I can define myself as a stand-up.
Right.
Then you sort of slide into the writing. There's a new definition. You got to sit down and go, okay, there's a new definition now. Now, not that you can't.
For myself?
for myself. Uh-huh. Not that you can't be a stand-up and a writer.
Right.
But to be just a writer now, which is a lot of stand-ups. You go, oh, what are you doing? And you're like, well, you know, I'm writing this, I'm writing that. And then the stage thing is gone.
But as you get older, and even as, you know, before you get older, I mean, there's fewer and fewer stand-ups that are going to be like, ah, you pussy. Well, you know what I mean? Like, unless you have that guy inside of you.
Yeah, well, that guy is definitely inside of me, and pussy is a
nothing
is a charitable way. You know, things the things that I hear from that guy, I would love it. I'm like, can you just stay at pussy? Can you are really
he's creative,
Jesus,
huh?
Can I just yeah. Well, he's creative. What is he's consistent, because I'm letting down everybody
by not doing any stand up or a lot of things.
I'm tearing. I'm destroying the race.
Oh yeah,
I'm destroying myself
by being a writer.
I'm letting my family down. You know, it's just all kinds of stuff.
He's very active, huh? He's got a he's on stage a lot. That guy in your head.
Well, that's the thing. It's like when I was on stage, he could calm down and just go, yeah, you know. These people, whatever.
He had a voice.
Yeah, but now he's like, oh, it's just me in here. Oh, okay, you cool with it. And this is what you want then, right? You just want me to fuck with you because you ain't even going out doing nothing. You know what I mean? Yeah.
That's a good question, though. Do you want it? Like, you know, when you have those kind of feelings about yourself and those kind of patterns in yourself. I was just talking about this to my brother the other day, yesterday. Where it's sort of like, you know, you circle around, you end up in the same place emotionally, psychologically, right. You know, where you're beating the shit out of yourself. And after a certain point, you're like, well, some part of you is comfortable here.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's not healthy. It's not good. It doesn't lead to a good place, but something in you is used to it.
But you're good here.
Yeah.
So what are you bitching about? Just shut up and be here. But
that's it, the acceptance thing.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, in your heart that acceptance is the right place to be. But then it's like, what am I accepting, though?
Yeah.
Am I accepting the best of myself, or have I given up?
And that's so you just take it to another level. Like, you know, like, okay, I get it, but, you know, it's still shitty. It's still shit.
And it's like, well, I feel like, look, I'll say this. Maybe this is a comparison that's fair. Maybe it's not. I just did the thing. I'm 54. I think we're both 54.
I'm 54 September.
And I'm 54 in October. But I'm the kind of person who just sits 54. I'm just jumping ahead.
Yeah, I'm 60, man. No, you're not.
I'm 78.
Well, I'm 53, but it's coming if I'm lucky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, so I'm 53, 54 in October. I just did my colonoscopy because, you know, you got to do that.
I did it last year or 2 years ago. I did it.
And so, first of all, I got the number. Like, here's the deal. Like, my doctor's, in my regular doctor's office, there's a guy who does it.
Oh, really? You didn't have to go?
No.
I went to some weird sort of like a place that doctors use.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, we went to a place.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, like I didn't have to go find a doctor who does it.
Right, right, right.
The doctor is right over there.
I said
to him, I'm actually 51. I said, I'm 51 now. And I know that at 50, I'm supposed to do that. Yeah. Everybody says do this thing. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're 51, sure. You want me to recommend somebody? And I say, yeah, please. And he goes, there's this guy next door. Which immediately you go, is that a real recommendation? Or are you just helping out your sweet mate?
Right.
And then, like I said, I just did it. I just did it like 3 months ago. So that means
you put it off.
It took me, that long to get.
Well, what was it? You didn't want to see the results? You didn't want to have something in your ass?
I didn't want to
see the results.
Oh, okay. I didn't. It was probably both. but it was more the results. And then when I got the results, when he says, I got the paper, and he says, yeah, you're good for another 10 years.
Right, yeah.
I said immediately, I was like, 10 years? Fuck, that guy's going to be retired. He's an old guy.
Oh, right.
I'm already coming up in my brain with why 10 years is a bad thing.
Right.
As opposed to I'm clean for 10 years.
Yeah.
So, and I'm saying, like, in what we were talking about, like, I don't know if I should go, can you just be satisfied with where you are right now and not be so worried about 10 years from now? Or is it legitimate? You know, and I feel like in this case, it's a case-by-case basis. In this case.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a weird way to go with it. You know what I mean? Right. In the sense that, like, I know people like that. I'm very anxious in the moment. But I think when they told me I had, I didn't have 8 to 10 years, I'm good. Well, I thought, well, that's like that's. See, what I do is like, well, that's off the list. Let's check out the liver. How's right, the, you know, right. which of the other organs are going to go?
Something else could happen.
That's right. Like right. That one's good for now. That part of me is yeah. operating fine. But let's do the prostate again. Let's figure out what's up with that.
Yeah, that was I might get into that, but I get more arrogant about it because I feel like hey man, my ass is clean.
Yeah.
Liver, prostate, they better be clean.
Yeah, right.
Because then I'm going to be like, that guy in my head will be like, what's up with you, prostate?
Yeah.
The ass is clean, but look at you. Yeah. You got to grab onto some cancer, you stupid ass. You know, thank you, Mr. Asshole.
Right, but, right.
I'm sorry. How far can
you
I?
You can go.
I can say whatever.
Yeah. All right. But you grew up with it, like, because I remember the early bits and the defining bits and the fact that you're still thinking about this stuff, you know, without a release valve.
Yeah.
Must be a little hard to handle. I mean, that must be a source of some of your self-criticism that, you know, at the beginning when you were doing jokes about your father and your grandmother and the unique sort of set of circumstances that you grew up in ideologically.
Right.
You know, at least you had that release valve. So now you're kind of festering.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, yes, you're right. And then it's deeper than that. What I realized is my release valve was some fake oration.
Fake oration.
Some fakery. I was not being as honest as I could be.
Well, I mean, you're doing comedy, you know, and you could progress to that.
Yeah, yeah. And I know, and I think that's why comedy became my thing. And that's why, like I'm saying, I'm torn between comedy and history. Maybe I'm not torn. Maybe I'll figure out how to weave it all together.
Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Baltimore.
Right.
I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm sorry. Just for your listeners, I grew up in Baltimore City.
Uh-huh.
So anybody who goes, I grew up in Baltimore, and then they say, yeah, Pikesville or Reisterstown, these are all little areas
yeah.
around Baltimore. No.
Yeah.
Baltimore City.
And that means something.
it totally means something.
My point of reference is The Wire.
That's The Wire is, for the most part, about the part of Baltimore City I grew up in.
And like, how big was the family?
My family was pretty big, I think. I'll put it like this. My mom had three older brothers, and my dad had... He had three siblings. He had two older brothers and an older sister.
Yeah.
So both were the babies of the family.
Right.
But there were three siblings.
And everybody was around?
Everybody. Nah, my mom's oldest brother, Uncle Everett, was a crazy vet. He was Army, Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
He died in Vietnam.
He did?
Yeah, it's weird to say died. He killed. He was yeah. killed. You know, I mean, yeah. you know he expired
yeah.
over there. Dude, and he was as I remember, you know, I mean, you're dealing with the kids' memories.
Right.
But I remember he was really a good uncle, and he was really nice and crazy, which is what you want sometimes from a good uncle.
You got to know him between tours or before he went?
Yeah, he'd come home between tours, and then, I mean, I'm sure I knew him before he went, but I was really
right,
little.
You right, right.
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But me and my cousin, his son,
yeah.
my cousin Everett, we both lived with my grandmother, my mom's, my maternal grandmother for
yeah.
a while.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, and we lived in the room. I mean, it was public housing. And there were only two bedrooms. And so at one point, I mean, we were all in the same room. And then my grandmother, because this is who she is, and she just moved downstairs. It was like this huge staircase. She just basically made the couch. That was her room.
And
the living
room
was her
room. And you and your cousin lived upstairs?
Me and my cousin lived in one room. And then the other room was like when my Uncle Everett came home, and sometimes... Uncle Richard and Uncle William.
And where was your mom?
Where she was gone. My mother and my grandmother had a really contentious relationship.
Yeah.
My mother had a contentious relationship with a lot of people, but my mother is a very loving person. But and there's so much about her that there's so much about me that she's responsible
for. She's still around?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's good.
But the thing I guess that really kills me is like she and my, when she talks about her mother, my grandmother, they're so alike. They're so the same person that I hope like someday before she expires, she sees that.
Oh,
she sees that you are the daughter of this woman who was fighting the things that you were fighting, except she was fighting them 20 years. You know, she was fighting them before you.
Yeah. It's weird that blindsiding people, you know, like the parent you fight the most is probably the one you're the most like.
Totally like that. Yeah. And I've seen that. Oh, I see it with my friends. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
And my mom, because my mom talks about like sometimes when she's, there's like four or five like consistent stories that my mother tells.
Yeah.
And one of them is about when she got put out. Like her mom just said, get out. I don't want you here. Get out of the house. And she said, and I was outside and I was at court and I was crying and I was just begging her, please let me back in, please. You know, and she said, no. It's like, and one thing was, because I used to live with her, like it was clear. My grandmother had a line, she was an iron rod. Like, this is it.
Yeah.
I have declared, I've made the statement, and that's it. It's not changing.
Right.
And so my mother was like, you know, she talks about how, terrible she felt and how humbled she felt and abandoned. And she was. I mean, you know, your mother says, get out of my house. I don't care where you go. I don't care what happens to you.
What was the reason?
I'm not, there's never been a very clear, you know what I'm saying? When you tell that story, it's never like, oh, and this is because I had done this, which means to me, when, you know, people tell stories, you go, so you did something.
Yeah, right.
Something that even now you go,
that's the missing part.
Like, somehow this was your fault.
Right.
But
you had it coming.
Yeah, well, that part I wouldn't go that far.
Right.
But you should have known.
Right.
You knew you were dealing with.
Right, yeah.
And so this happened. Now, at the same time, when I was, I think, 17, certainly after school.
Yeah.
And my mother had this whole idea of how I was going to live my life and be this different.
After high school?
Person after high school and after, like, I joined the Marines. And then she was like, that's not happening. Because I was 17 when I graduated. And so, you know, you got to get a parent. You go and the recruiter's like, okay, sure.
Just take this home and get your mom to sign it?
And she's like, that ain't happening. I've seen, you know, and part of it was like, I've seen what they did to my brother.
Yeah.
Both my oldest, Uncle Everett, died in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Uncle Everett was Army. Uncle William was Marines.
Right.
And the Marines were so impressed with him, and it was the 60s, and there was a whole need for Negro officers, that they sent him to Annapolis. They were like, you know what? We want you to become an officer.
To the academy?
We're okay with you as an officer. Yeah. So they send him to the academy, and then he goes back as a captain. But like kind of around the time that the war's over, And so like I grew up around him, and I admired him a lot.
You know,
there's a lot of stuff about him I didn't like that much, but I had a real admiration for him as a man. You know, and this is the thing, you grow up, and that was why I think this started with you talking about my act and my dad. A lot of my talk of my dad is an amalgamation of a lot of stuff.
Is he a real person?
My dad is a real person. The things that my dad did that truly influenced me are things that I still kind of work with on an quieter basis. Because, you know, the dad I talked about on the stage is very much in your face and loud. And that's that voice in my head that I kind of give him credit for.
But, right.
I think my dad was... wanted to be a lot of things. Like I think that my dad, if he were around, would be, it's emotional, sorry. It's weird. That was a weird thing. I was going to say, I think he would be proud of me. And I never really thought of that. Because I think that what I did, what I was doing when I was doing stand-up, yeah. I think he would have really been like somebody to brag about that.
And he wasn't around already?
No, my dad died. My dad's story in my world is pure comedy. Some of it horribly funny, I think, comedy. My dad. No, this. Can I tell you a few things about my dad?
Is
on the WTF podcast, the F being father.
Yeah.
I remember early on, like my mom used to date this guy, Clinton.
Yeah.
And this guy taught me how to play chess.
Right.
All right. And I didn't like this guy. But at the time, I didn't like him.
Yeah. How old were you?
Around 9 or 10. Yeah. The deal was Clinton taught me to play chess.
Yeah.
And one day my dad said he saw that there was a chessboard at that house.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I didn't know you know how to play. And I said, yeah, sure. So he said, let's play. So we started to play a game of chess. And he's awful.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I was like, all right. Well, yeah. That's the move you're going to make. But then it got to a point. I think like a few moves in that I thought, I don't want to beat him. I don't want to beat my dad. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
So I just stopped. I was like, oh, okay. And I started making like stupid moves.
Right.
And then he won. And then he was like, yeah. He said, well, you know, I can help you out. Like, yeah. Teach you a few things. And I said, yeah. Okay.
So that was the dynamic.
That was kind of the thing. Like, it was like, I'm protecting him. And he's a good guy. Like, so this is the thing, like later on, once my dad came to me, this stuck with me for years. He came to me, he said, you got $2. And I did.
Yeah.
He said, I need $2. He said, I just need $2.
Yeah.
I got this 50, but I don't need to be out here in these streets with this $50 bill.
Right.
But I could use $2, $1 bills. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you the 50. You hold on to that. You give me the $2. I'm going to be back in about an hour and a half. If I don't come back, if I'm not a man of my word,
yeah.
If I don't come back here in an hour and a half, you keep that $50 bill.
Right.
Because you got to be a man of your word.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Yeah. That's a good deal, right?
Yeah.
You know? So I give him the $2. And I didn't even think about it, I guess, until like maybe an hour.
Yeah.
Like an hour into it, I'm looking out the window, I'm rubbing my hands together, okay? Yes.
Yeah.
I'm about to come up with $50.
Yeah.
And then he came back. He came back within the time limit.
Yeah.
And he gave me my $2 back. And I gave him his $50 back. But then for years, I was like, my dad is so... There's a lot of integrity that was seems so on. My dad's an honest guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like he gave me $50 that I could have if he didn't stick to his word.
Right.
I think I was probably in my mid-40s before I thought, really? Do you really think that your dad would have let you keep that $50?
Right.
Like if he'd have come back like 2 hours later and said, hey, man, listen.
Yeah.
I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you $3 back.
Yeah.
But you're going to give me my money. You know?
Right.
But I don't really ever know. He might be, because there's times with me, like I take a very hard line about, you know what? No, I said it was going to be this way. And so, but I think some of that is because I'm still clinging to that like childhood thing. Like that's what I always remember about him. And so, you know, we catch up and we made some things. I said, I gotta start exercising. I used to be a real scrawny kid. I said, I need to bulk up a little bit, you know. And so he would send me exercises he's found, like, you know, and just stuff. Hey, man, you know, good to talk to you. Good to see you.
Right.
Like 6 months later, I get this call. He's in the VA. Sick. He's got cancer. He's dying.
Yeah.
He's almost dead.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, what the fuck? That never came up.
He knew?
He must have known. It's like 6 months?
Come
on. And, you know, like for me, thinking back at it, it was like, because the call was so out of the blue. So now it's like, oh, okay. So like he gets this diagnosis and it's like, let me try to tie up some loose ends.
Yeah.
He's got this kid. Let me go talk to him. And so, you know, I was just like, what? Okay. And my uncle, his brother calls me and says, yeah, your daddy, you going to go see him? You know?
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, yeah. So I go to the VA. And I was a little pissed, you know, because I'm like, why? When you could have talked about this, but I'm in my head, I'm back and forth. Like,
yeah.
I guess he didn't know.
Yeah.
Why talk about this thing that's bothering him? And he wants to know what's up with me. And I guess he wants to know that I'm going to continue my journey and be okay, you know. And I go, they let me in, and it's intensive care.
Yeah.
So it's only a few people allowed in at a time. And this nurse lets me in. And I go in, and like I said, I got all that in my head. And I'm looking at him, like, this guy is being ravaged. So I know he knew he had this.
Yeah.
Now it's like, look at it. It's so thin and weird. And I was like, damn, it's like, I don't know what to say to you, man. I'm like, and he's not conscious, really. You know, I said, I'm kind of mad, but I don't want to be mad because I want you to know that I'm you know, and then the nurse taps me on my shoulder and says, "Piss me." I said, "What?" She goes, "Hutcherson?" And I go, "Yeah." She goes, that "Over there."
Come on.
I swear to God.
You're the wrong guy.
I was talking to the wrong. So then I go over here. But it's the same thing. When I go over to the bed that she pointed me to,
same
I'm still
condition.
Like,
no, he's out of
he's
it.
Unconscious and unrecognizable. It's
right.
Still like,
right. Yeah, yeah.
I was still like, okay. Yeah, I can't even work myself up to what happened over there.
Yeah, yeah.
I just go.
You had a dry run.
Yeah.
Rehearsal.
And then, but that rehearsal was it. That's all that was in me. Yeah, I was like, you know, I said, man, I don't know what to say to you. I don't know if you can even hear me. And I'm looking at the, you know, there's the
EKG
heart monitor,
thing,
the beep. Like, is there anything that's going to show that there's a hint of recognition to the fact that I'm even here? And I'm like, no. I don't think so, you know.
Yeah.
And I kind of patted his hand and I said, well, I came by, you know, I'm going to come by again. And I left, you know, and I think like 2 days later, that same uncle called me up and we have issues. I mean, we had issues. We're very cool now.
Yeah.
But he, because this is what he does. He calls me up. You know your daddy dead now, right? Like, okay. No. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He just did. They just passed away. And I guess the hospital had his number.
Right,
you know
right,
what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it had just happened. And he was like, yeah, well, that's over. So the deal is, and where the dad on stage came from. So then I get this call basically. They're like, well, you're 18 now. This is March, actually. I just turned 18 in October.
Yeah.
Now it's March. And you're the executor of your dad's estate. You have to bury him. You have to take care of all of these things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I called my friends who all had dads except for one who I think didn't. Well, I mean, everybody obviously has a dad.
But, right.
You know, that didn't know his dad. And they were, you know, consoling, but they didn't really get it. Because then there was a whole thing of like, dude, you never talked about your dad before. And I go, yeah. They're like, so are you worried? Are you upset? I was like, I guess. I don't know, you know. When the one group, I had like three friends who kind of took me out drinking. So we got like, and we had the worst shit. We had like Thunderbird.
Right.
And Jack Daniels. And we kind of hung out. And it's actually at a graveyard, which is ridiculous. And I drank. I basically drank all night, but felt nothing.
Yeah.
You know, like I didn't remember feeling drunk. And I totally remember like that night. And then the next day, because the next day I went to get my uncles and I was driving around.
Yeah.
And they were like, you were drinking last night? And I said, yeah, I was. And they were like,
why do you think that?
You're pretty steady.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess on some emotional, I was trying to anesthetize that feeling that I did. Like, I don't even know what this feeling is, but it's wrong. You know,
yeah, it wasn't grief. It was just sort of like it didn't have an effect that you thought it should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I remember years ago, I went to see a guy who talked about Vietnam.
Yeah.
He said that he worked in the, he sorted body parts.
Right.
Said, this is where I worked in, like, whatever, the field hospital where I had to identify this body part goes with this. And he said, He said, I drink 2 pints of Jack Daniels every day. Every day. He said, yeah. I just drank that to get through it. He said, and I can't, there's nobody that can tell you that they ever saw me drunk. It was like, just that is what I needed to deal with what I was doing.
Right.
And I think that that drinking on that night was what I needed just to deal with this thing. Like all these, we're never going to have a discussion.
Right.
We're never, there's a million things that are never going to happen.
Right.
For me and my dad.
Yeah.
And I guess I had always sort of stuffed that away because he existed and I knew where he was.
Right.
And it was like, well, at some point we'll have a relationship, but now that's not the case.
Right.
So yeah, that was that's the ordeal. Extent.
So when did you start doing comedy?
I started doing comedy, I was 22. I started writing comedy. What happened was I was in, this is another, I don't know, maybe it was my dad, maybe somebody. Basically, we didn't believe in loans. I don't believe in loans. So to go to college, you gotta work, or live on some saved money,
right?
And so, and I didn't even want to go. I was like, I don't see the point of this. I struggled for the last year of high school, not academically, but just like, what is this about? But anyway, at the Community College of Baltimore, I met a guy who wanted to do comedy. He wanted to be partners.
Yeah,
I had no interest anymore in hard news, solid things. I was all about features. I was a feature writer for the college newspaper.
So you'd be a reporter?
No, I was actually in school for nursing. I was gonna be a nurse.
And then did your mother put you out already?
Yeah, she had. I was out. Yeah.
Was that a hostile thing or was
it? Totally hostile. It was absolutely hostile. She was mad. I mean,
what was she mad about?
She was mad that I wasn't living, which I think was the exact same thing with her mother. It's like, I had a notion of what you would be like as an adult or as a young adult, and you're not living up to it. It was just like, I didn't, like I said, I wasn't really interested in the college thing. I had a job. Like I got a job immediately out of high school, and but I was unfocused.
Right.
And she was like, focus.
Yeah.
You got to focus, and the way out of this is college.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not so sure college is for me. Mm. And the way out of this isn't so bad. Mm-hmm. You know, which parents hate. You know, this is okay. We're all right.
What were you doing?
For a living?
Yeah.
I worked in a pharmacy. I had started as just a clerk, but then the guy trained me. So I was the pharmacy tech.
Okay. But that wasn't your future.
No, but it could have been. Well, that was the whole deal. Like, kind of going into nursing, I was like, oh, I could go into pharmacy, or I could be a pharmacy tech. Pharmacy techs are actually do the work.
Yeah.
The pharmacist takes the credit.
But it wasn't necessarily something you want to do with your future. You're just doing a job.
Right. You know, but it's something I could have done for money and been fine.
Right. And she wasn't having it.
She was like, dude, you got to follow your thing. You got to be you. Like, you know, parents do that thing of like, find yourself, and you go, well, I'm right here. I found myself. And
right.
That's not you, though. So anyway, I go and I say, well, okay. I meet this guy, and this guy's like, you know, basically I used to joke around the office.
But eventually you went to community college, and you're writing.
I go to community college, and I'm writing on the school paper because that was more fun, and I enjoy writing.
And your mom was happy?
No. She's like, this, you're doing some more stuff. And we weren't talking. This is after I got put out. So we're not really communicating.
Right.
You know, what I do, I do.
And right.
She doesn't care. I mean, she probably cares, but I wasn't trying to.
You came back around, though.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But, no. So I go and I joke around in the office.
Right.
I joke around a lot in the office of the newspaper. Yeah. And this guy goes, you know, I'm thinking of going to this comedy club downtown, but we might. It might be better off if, like, we're partners. You want to partner up? Yeah. And I go, sure, why not? You know, whatever, what the hell?
Try it.
And so then he starts setting rehearsal times, and he's got a schedule, like, let's get together and write. I'm like, dude, are you crazy? This is school again.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Were you performing as a team?
No, this was the thing. I'm like, you get why I'm in community college, right?
Right.
Because this is a last ditch effort.
Yeah.
I didn't, this wasn't the plan.
Yeah.
So he was like, well, I really want to do this. I go, here's what we'll do then. why don't you run, tell me some of the stuff that you want to do. And he goes through some jokes. Horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Were you a comedy fan?
I was a big fan of comedy. Yeah. And I say to this guy, I'll write these. I'll fix these jokes for you.
Yeah.
You just go up. You and I are going to work on your writing.
Right.
And but as a team, I don't know. So we go down, and it's a big splash. It's like open mic night. He gets up. People are like, wow, that guy is funny.
With your jokes.
Sure. Yeah. And some of it, with a derivative of his, I'll say, with a couple of his premises.
Yeah.
My jokes. And then, and what we didn't know was the whole notion of like working out a set, working out a routine.
Right.
So we basically like, well, we did those jokes. And the next week we went back with all new jokes.
Right.
And then again, and then again, and again.
That must impress the open micers.
And there you go. Yeah. Well, not so much the open micers, but certainly the club owners, right. You know. So they were like, geez, this guy, about him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you start doing it on your own?
I guess about maybe 2 years after, and it was really a matter of, the deal was they didn't know who I was.
Sure.
They didn't know I was writing this stuff. And then one day, and
so you started out a writer.
I started out a writer.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah.
Yeah.
As far as I started out.
Well, you knew enough to know that.
I started out I was saving this guy. He's like, you're embarrassed.
But it's interesting though, but you were approaching jokes. You know, you had a sense of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And a sense of how to act on stage.
Right.
But then the thing is how I started out helping other people.
Right.
Because after a while, you know, like after the show and you sit around and you're talking and people come over and I would start helping other people in the club. Like, you should do this. You know that thing you do with the thing? Why don't you? And so they're like, this guy's funny.
Right.
And then it becomes this thing where, like, we kind of went out. We would always like hang out after the show.
Right.
It was always like, we're the comedy, we're the comedians
sure,
in Baltimore. And they started to get it. They started to go, one-on-one, when you're with the two of them, this is the funny guy.
Right.
This guy is not so fast or funny.
Right.
You know, and they were like, okay, so you're writing his stuff.
Right.
Oh, okay, we get it.
Yeah.
And so then there was this, why don't you go up? What's your deal? Like, we're hanging out with you, you're funny, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't know. And then finally, I make this pact. I go, like, there was this one guy who used to come.
Yeah.
The guy who got me, he's a drug dealer. And he used to come, and this was like the weird thing. Like, I didn't know he was a drug dealer.
Yeah.
But the deal was he would come, and then he would disappear.
Right.
Come open mic night, disappear. Weeks. And then come back and be in the same place.
Yeah.
Like, you think if you went away, you thought about something.
Right.
Came back, you're much better. So.
Was he doing comedy?
Yeah, he'd do comedy. He'd get on stage and just be like, what is this guy doing? And then I said, if that guy ever comes back, the day that guy comes back, I'll get on stage. Because I can't stand to see the audience tortured by that.
Right.
And he comes back.
Yeah.
And I went up. It's fucking the arrogance. I went up with this so much because of everything I just told you. Because in my head, I'm like, I'm writing jokes for that guy. I'm writing jokes for this guy.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm constantly coming up with tags and punchlines. I got to write.
Yeah.
I'm going to write 5 minutes. You know what? I'm going to get up there and do 5 minutes.
Right.
You clowns.
Yeah.
I'll show you.
Right.
It's a whole other thing, you know?
Yeah.
I got on the stage like, oh. It's just a different world.
Yeah.
Looking out at the people, looking back at you with the expectation in your eyes. And I mumbled through some stuff. I got nothing. I got no love.
Yeah.
And I tried, and I attacked some people. I mean, I call it attacked. I tried to talk to some people in the crowd.
Yeah.
And my heart is pounding. And it was awful.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And what happens when you get off?
And so I get off, and I was like, "What? That is awful.
Yeah,
that is the worst thing ever."
I got to go on next week.
Well, this is my thing, and that voice in my head thing is. Then I get forensic with it, and I got to figure out all the variables. That doesn't make sense to me. I shouldn't have, like, all that other stuff I thought before about how I write for everybody else and I do this and that. So that shouldn't have happened,
right?
So what happened? Like, well, okay, well, I wasn't prepared, obviously, yeah. So I got to prepare. But then all of those things, for me to suss out all the variables,
yeah.
I got to keep going back up.
Right. You got to master this thing. You got to fix it.
I have to, exactly.
Got to get save face.
Right. And then I had a girlfriend at the time who was like 100% behind, who was actually in the Army. She was like, that was my military connection. She was like, you're going to just not do it again? I go, I think... Maybe that's best for me to not do it again.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't know you. I don't know that guy.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, you're right. I'm going to do it again. I got to do it. I got to kill it.
So,
yeah. And then I had a whole conversation with Andre where I go, look, here's what we got to do. Because I'm going to keep writing for you.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, we got to differentiate. So let's make a decision. Like, he's very political. He's like, you like the political stuff. I'm going to write that. I'm going to write these jokes for you.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to write the more lighthearted family junk.
Yeah.
For me, you know, but it's all in the name of laughs.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, cool for like a couple weeks. And then he got to the point where he said, you know what? I think I got it.
Yeah.
I can write my own jokes.
Yeah.
And then that freed me. You know, and the only thing that I did make sure of was like to never step on his toes. Like if he got up with some premise, I go, okay, well, I'll leave that alone.
So now you're doing it.
Yeah, now I'm doing it. And now without that anchor.
Yeah.
Without being constrained with like working for everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly in a few months, I'm emceeing.
Yeah.
Then I do a commercial. Like, there's this local commercial. These people come by and they see us.
Yeah.
And they hire me and a couple other guys from the club. And we do these commercials. And then and now I'm known. Like, people, I go around. I walk around Baltimore. And people, like, I had made up. It's for a car dealership.
Yeah.
And I had made up the Reverend Mitsubishi.
Yeah.
So yeah. People were like, oh, he's the Reverend.
That's a guy.
Mitsubishi, that's that guy, you know? And it's great in the city. It's just like being a local sportscaster.
Sure.
You're great in your city.
Yeah.
You step 20 miles out. Nobody knows who you are. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
I started doing that. And then I started getting bookings. Didn't even have a phone. I had people called Dan Rosen.
Yeah.
Because they were like, Dan had a phone. The way I was working, the way I had budgeted my money, I was like, I don't need to pay a phone.
Yeah.
Who am I? I know everybody I know, I just go see them.
Yeah.
So
you did shit to kind of hold yourself back on some level.
Still. Yeah. You know, from the beginning.
You always make it harder for yourself.
I'm making it harder for myself.
Yeah.
And I'm still, and that's the thing where I'm at now. Like, I'm still doing that.
Yeah.
Or I started doing it again.
Right.
And now I got to stop.
Right.
Because now I make it all about my kid. And I'm like, you know what? That kid doesn't deserve to have me go, yeah, you know what? I turned my back on comedy because you need me too much.
Right.
You know what I mean? I got to be home and take care of you.
Yeah.
Whereas there'd be people who go, what a hero. And I'm like, no, not really.
What's his issue?
What a coward. They don't. He's undiagnosed is the most true thing. But it's like clearly like cerebral palsy, and you know, he's nonverbal.
Yeah,
he's not mobile. You know, he's not. His limbs don't obey his commands.
Uh huh.
There's a host of things to deal with.
Right.
He's also, in my estimation, very smart, very clever. And the thing I realize about kids, if there's anything about them, they absolutely kind of come. If you're paying attention to them, they're here to help you, I think. I really feel that way.
Yeah.
I feel like, and with both of them, I said this to a friend of mine. I said, you know what? I realized there's nothing I say to my kids. There's not one piece of, and I'm talking about a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, but there's not one piece of advice that I say to them that is not absolutely intended for me. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, some circumstances change, but you know, you go, look, who cares what the other kids in your class think about you?
Yeah.
What's important is how you feel and what you do. And then you can have that argument with them and then look at yourself in the mirror and go, well, really?
Yeah.
you want to tell yourself that right now?
You're still telling yourself that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so But they make it more concise. They make it more clear. And then, this is the deal with my son and the fear and all the stuff that we talked about. There's this stuff that my son can do.
Yeah.
That he doesn't do because he's a 10-year-old boy in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
That people have affection for.
Right.
And so, as I'm constantly saying to him, dude, you have to stop relying on that. You know?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a point where, and he goes to the school where they have 30% of the kids are special needs. Everything. Mm-hmm. All along the spectrum of special needs. And not to say spectrum, because that that leans to
all different kinds autism, of special needs. Yeah.
But everything. And this is what puts me in a place where I'm like, I guess, any other parent, you know. You want to say to your kid, you understand how lucky you are? You understand what a great opportunity this is?
Yeah.
And in a way, my kids, I totally get it, which is why I don't talk, which is why I make sure. He does this, he'll start crying and kicking. And I'll go, here's the deal. And I've been doing this for 4 years now. Like, what do you need? You know, in Chinese, yes is hi. Mm-hmm. You can say hi, you know. So instead of you trying to wrap your mouth around the word yes, here's the deal. When you want something, if I ask you something and the answer is affirmative, if the answer is yes, say hi.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you get it?
And I'm going to write down all these things. Like, I'll educate your teachers. It's going to be your language.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's going to be Zave's language.
Based on what he's can
do. Based on what you can do.
Right.
Based on me seeing what you can do. Did he get it? I think he absolutely gets it. Does he do it? No. Dude, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to scream and cry.
Yeah.
And you are going to figure it out like everybody else. I mean, that's what infants do. Like, this is what I say to him. I go, that's what infants do. They cry. The parents pick them up and they say, what's wrong? Are you hungry?
Yeah.
You got to go to the bathroom. You need to be burned. And they figure it out eventually.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then the kid gets satisfied. And then they get whatever. What they get out of that is like, okay, you care about me. You hung out. You figured it out.
Yeah. And I didn't have to jump through any hoops.
Exactly.
Or try to do something.
And this is what, and so we have that conversation constantly. But at the school, they do have to jump through that hoop.
Yeah.
If he's in class and he starts screaming, well, the teacher's got to figure it out. And then sometimes she just says to, there's an aide, and he goes, take him to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I talk to the aides and I'll go, what happened? And they'll go, well, like, he started screaming. And I said, it sounds like if they describe the day, they describe what was going on, especially if they were doing math.
Yeah.
And I'll say, so what happened? So you took him out? And I'll say, yeah, well, so we left to go to the bathroom, and then he stopped. And I go, let me ask you this. Did he stop the minute you walked out of the class, or did he stop when you got to the bathroom? And they'll go, oh, yeah, you know, he actually stopped like as soon as we walked out of the class.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, and he didn't go to the bathroom, right? And I go, yeah, no, he just kind of sat.
Yeah.
He sat, and then I got him up. And then we went back to the class, and he started screaming again. And I go, dude.
He doesn't want to do math.
Doesn't want, yeah, exactly. He doesn't want to do math, and then you do this thing. You go to this infantile behavior because you know there's going to be more. You're going to get more credit for that. There's going to be more sympathy. And then I want to go, and I say to him, I go, look, that sympathy goes away. Trust me, when you're the 15-year-old screaming like a baby in the corner, people are going to say, can somebody please shut that kid up? You know, it's
you're
not,
telling him this.
I'm telling him this all the time. I'm telling him all the time.
So this is the struggle.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
This is the beautiful struggle.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, like I'm saying to you, I have these long conversations with him, and then I go and look in the mirror and go, really, dude? Really?
Yeah.
You just had that? You're sitting here crying and screaming, oh, I'm writing for everybody else. I need to get myself together and back on stage. Everything you say to
him. This is something that's eating at you every day.
I can't say eating at me,
okay,
but it's in my head. It's present.
Right, so let's go back. So you do comedy, eventually you move to New York where I met you.
Yeah.
And you're doing those shows that I did, the Caroline's Comedy Hour, the Evening at the Improv. We're all getting those first breaks.
Yeah, yeah.
So your first job, where did you go to SNL? The writing job?
First writing job was SNL.
But how long were you in comedy then? Like five, like six, 7 years?
Maybe six. Well, I'll tell you this. Yeah, because I remember this. There was a show at SNL. I remember the Jordan. Is it Michael Jordan in Public Enemy? That was my 10-year reunion, 10-year high school reunion. And I thought it out, and I was like, okay. So I graduated at 17. I started comedy at 22.
Yeah.
So I'm 27 now. So
5 years.
5 years from when I started.
You're working at SNL.
I'm working at SNL.
So now at that point, though, were you like, you know, this comedy life looks, you know, why not take that gig?
The deal with the SNL thing was I miscalculated.
Yeah.
I basically, you know, I'm from Baltimore. I'm used to going up and down 95
right.
to do my gigs. Every once in a while I go west, never came as far as out here.
Doing the Jersey shit, Boston shit.
I did the Jersey. I did Boston.
Philly shit.
I did the Philly shit, but I didn't do Boston shit until I moved to New York.
Right.
I was doing a little Chillicothe, Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, Prestonsburg, Kentucky. I had gotten to the point where I was headlining.
Yeah.
And then I got to the point where I realized the only thing I like about headlining was every once in a while, a nice small crowd to talk to. Can I say like one quick story?
Yeah.
The one time I realized this is what I love to do, but this is what I love to do with these people. Me and Patton.
Yeah.
In Alaska.
Yeah.
Right, I don't know if it was Juneau or some one of those towns and one of the cities, and we do our show. I think we were there for a week, and we you know, it was fine. A week was fine. Last show,
yeah,
six people,
yeah, best show of the week.
Two couples,
yeah.
Well, for me,
yeah.
Patton was like, ugh,
yeah,
I don't know what the hell this is. And six black people,
right?
Six black people love Alaska,
uh-huh.
You know, and they come to this show. And like, yeah, Patton goes up and he does his thing. He does his Patton thing and he's fine. And they're very respectful of him. Uh-huh. You know, it's like Patton's like, if I was a superhero, juice would come out of my fingers and
right.
stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They just go.
Early Patton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he comes, he sits down. He goes, man, I don't know what to tell you. Good luck. And I get up and I start talking to them.
Yeah.
And I asked the guy, it was two couples and then two, you know, other, and I said, so you guys, like when you came in and you noticed that the crowd wasn't filling up around you, did you think for a second, maybe we shouldn't stay?
I always wonder that.
And they said, this guy said, well, this was the last night.
Yeah.
He said, well, we had made this plan to come here and we came to see you. I was like, but now the pressure's on, and now, and like everything I'm just talking to you about, like the old, like I'm responsible for these people. This is a community thing. These people live all the way in Alaska. I have no idea what their life is like.
Yeah,
but there's six black people who came to see me, and then these people start coming in and being loud, and the deal was there was some wedding at another hotel across the street.
Yeah.
And it was so crowded over there that they decided to come over here.
Right.
And this doesn't look like a comedy show. This looks like one guy on stage talking to his friends.
Yeah.
So then I got to deal with them.
Right.
But then I start talking about them to these people. I'm like, well, see, now if that was us, they would be all like, oh, these loud black people. Yeah. And they start laughing. And I think I did like half act, half conversation.
Yeah.
With those people. And I was like, this is
where it's
good.
At. Yeah,
this
yeah.
is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And this was years after I couldn't figure out what the hell with SNL. So SNL was, money-wise, I was like, where's my money going? You know, New York is expensive as hell.
Yeah.
And it just got to that point. I was like, where the hell is my money? I'm very good with my money.
Yeah.
And it's leaving. It's going too fast. And I think at the point I was doing SNL, I was doing, I had Catch. I was emceeing at Catch on Sunday night and Tuesday night.
Catch Rising Star.
Yes.
This is like early 90s, yeah.
Early 90s, mm-hmm. The Louis Ferranda years.
Oh, God, yeah.
and I was still working around, you know? And I didn't understand what the hell was up with the money. And I realized, yeah, I'm driving twice. Like, if I got the gig that I used to have every year in North Carolina, I used to drive from Baltimore to North Carolina.
Right, so now you're flying.
No, I'm still driving, but I'm driving down. First, I'm doing the New Jersey Turnpike, and then I'm going over the bridge. Yeah, I'm paying these tolls. I'm spending more money eating food. New York, just coming through the damn tunnel is $5 to come in, and everything is $2 more than it is living in Baltimore. So everything is crazy.
So you're doing SNL.
Well, and that's why I did SNL. Oh, okay. I did SNL because I was like, this is a steady paycheck.
Who was the cast in?
The cast was Dana. Dana was kind of, it's not right to say in decline.
Yeah.
But Mike was definitely in ascendancy.
Yeah.
So it was Dana and Mike and Phil Hartman, who was a stellar individual.
Who was Update?
Update was Nealon.
Yeah.
Kevin Nealon. What's his name? Dennis Miller just left. And then our boys, Rock and Sandler and Rob Schneider and Spade.
Yeah. Good cast.
Yeah. And Farley, who, you know, was doing his thing already. But yeah, definitely a good group of people. And then the year after me, they hired Ellen Cleghorn and Timmy was there. And this was the thing, like between Tim and Chris and Ellen.
Yeah.
Probably the most until now.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had kind of gone down the road of blackness.
Right.
But it was making me crazy sometimes, you know, because it was kind of, to me, I was like, this what's happening here is, and Living Color is winning Emmys.
Yeah.
So Lauren hires Chris,
right,
who kind of came with an audience because people already knew Chris.
Right.
He didn't absolutely need SNL. So I got there, and like in that particular show I'm talking about with Chris and Ellen and Timmy, like the next week we wrote this sketch because it was Michael Jordan. It was Public Enemy, musical guest. Spike Lee came on.
Mm-hmm.
And did a guest thing on, Chris used to do the sketch, Nat X. And then Jesse Jackson came on because that week, two people died. Miles Davis died that week and Dr. Seuss died.
Yeah.
And Al Franken had, God bless him forever. Al Franken said, well, you know what we should do? We should get Jesse Jackson to come on and read an obituary. We'll write something for Dr. Seuss because of the rhyming.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, Jesse Jackson ain't going to do that, man. Are you kidding? He was on a plane. He was like, he did. You send a plane for me. I guess his son played football in some college. He said, send a plane. I'm going to be here. So we did that show. And that show was so many different things for me. The best thing I remember was just sitting on a fire escape, just me and Chuck D just talking.
Yeah.
Just shooting it.
Right.
And talking about Miles Davis. And because Lauren had come to me. He had assigned me this. He was like, Miles Davis just died. We'll write a little something. What are they going to say?
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
How long is something before they go, bring the noise? What are you talking about?
Right.
So Chuck I was like, why don't we just do a minute of silence or something like that for 20 seconds. So he did that. But then the next week, we wrote the sketch where like the opening monologue was Chris and Ellen and Tim. And I'm just going, okay, last week was probably the blackest Saturday Night Live, you know, with the three of us, plus Public Enemy, plus Michael Jordan, plus Jesse Jackson, plus Spike Lee. And then we wrote that. And then Lauren decided, like, kind of the last minute, nah, I don't want to do that. It's like, you know, his thing was he didn't want to serialize the show. Now, that's valid.
I'm like,
okay, I get that. He didn't want it to be like,
right,
if you watch that show and you go, oh, I wonder what last week was. You
right. know?
But then a part of me goes, that's actually selling. Now people have to go figure out what last week was. But that place, and I call it that place, was not, to me, is like, this place is not really conducive to just being creative and funny. It's very conducive to being competitive.
Yeah.
And I didn't come here for that.
Right.
And then, you know, when I think back on it, it was kind of being competitive. Like, so in the end, I go to Lauren, I think at the, like, the end of my second year, I go, I'm writing this stuff, and I love Chris. I love Chris, I love Timmy. But honestly, I don't think either one of them knows where I'm coming from sometimes with the things I write.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I don't know if he acknowledged that or not, he just listened. I gotten fed up with, I wrote this thing for Tim because I felt like he was underserved, underutilized.
Tim Meadows.
And I said, it was Ali's, his 50th, 60th mm-hmm. birthday. And I wrote this thing where it started out, I wrote a whole like slow roll until he got to a peak. And basically at the peak, it was like him calling himself the greatest feature player of all time. He's like, I'm the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
I don't care about no Chris Rock. I don't care about it. Just in everybody's face. I'm Tim Meadows.
Yeah.
I came here. And at the read through, people loved it.
Yeah.
And then I felt like the closer we got to air.
Yeah.
Dude started. It just got less and less appealing.
Uh-huh.
And not like the words of it, but the commitment, Tim's commitment seemed to be like even to the point Jim Downey said, I don't know what's going to happen with that piece.
Yeah.
Because Timmy, he's like, I don't, the Timmy's run through, his read through performance of that piece.
Yeah.
Was amazing.
Yeah.
Everybody went, look at Tim.
Yeah.
And then it was like,
Huh. And it didn't go?
And it didn't go. And I was like, okay, I could have done. So I go to Lauren, I go, I'm not, I know you got your thing. I don't want to be, clearly I'm not saying make me a member of the cast.
That's right.
You got to earn that. I'm not even saying make me a feature player.
Right.
So, but just from time to time, I got to write something that I know I can do.
Right.
And I agree. But Jim has a real issue if I take the writers, when I make writers feature players or performers on the show.
Uh-huh.
He says to me, he says, so, you know, I don't want to upset Jim. I love him. And it's this whole thing about
yeah.
him. He blames it all on Jim
right.
Downey. And
right.
Okay, cool. And I go to leave. Now, I had two, there are cliques there, and I can't pretend I didn't have my little crew.
Yeah.
But they were like the younger, Dave Mandel and Steve Corin were my boys.
Yeah.
And they asked, what happened? They knew what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And they asked what happened, and I go, man, he blamed it all on Jim. And it's like, because then Lauren said, go talk to Jim.
Yeah.
If you talk to Jim, and Jim says it's okay, then you got it. So I leave, and I say to them, all right, I'm out. I'm out of here. And they, what did he say? He said, talk to Jim, but come on, man.
Yeah.
Then they convinced me.
Yeah.
I let them convince me that if you never talk to Jim, you'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
You got to talk to Jim.
Yeah.
And so I talk. So I wait to talk to Jim. And here's the thing. This is the crazy. I've heard this guy a million times better. But there's a dysfunction. There was a huge dysfunction there about time and people's work ethic. Like I used to get to work when I worked at SNL.
Yeah.
I used to get there at 10 o'clock because somebody told me those were the hours.
Right. 10 o'clock in the morning?
10 a.m.
Yeah.
So I left home every day, 10 a.m., get to SNL. We didn't start work till 6, 7 o'clock, 7 p.m., 6, 7
p.m. So what were you doing all day?
I was hanging out. I was talking to, and that was the other thing. It wasn't like I would ever say, I'll just leave and wait until somebody calls me. Because that's what would happen.
Right.
People would just not be there, and they'll say, hey, call me when this is real, basically.
Yeah.
And so I hung out with the office staff. Those guys loved me. I had a good time with them.
Yeah.
And I think they didn't really get talked. There was a whole hierarchy.
Yeah.
And then it got crazy because then all of a sudden we start work at 7.
And you're tired?
Well, we're going to go from 7 to 2 to work on these sketches. So around 11:30, 12, I'm getting drowsy.
Yeah.
I would doze off, and then there would be someone around who's like, Jesus, Warren, what are you, what's your issue? Like, and that was like, it's Saturday Night Live. So the initial assumption is he's high, but it was like, people knew I was pretty straight. Yeah. So it's like, he's not high. It's just, what are you doing? You can't stay up. And oddly enough, one of the reasons I love Jim Downey, he knew. Jim was like, yeah, this guy got a break. He's been here since 10 o'clock.
Yes.
Like, how do you know, since the whole reason we're starting at 7 is because you didn't get here until 7 o'clock?
Did you talk to him about that thing?
So I go talk to him. Yes. But the reason I brought that story up is because my meeting with Lorne was supposed to be at 9 p.m. I talked to Lorne maybe at 2 in the morning. So I walk out of Lorne's office, and then I say to Jim's assistant, I got to talk to Jim.
Yeah.
And I'll have this conversation, I guess, tomorrow. And she goes, he's still here. If you want to wait a half hour, you can talk to him now. Okay. Well, half an hour becomes 4 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
So I talk to Jim at 4 in the morning. And this is the thing. Now I'm tired. This is like, this is some cult stuff. And I say, Jim, well, here's tell him the conversation I had with Lorne. And Lorne's, and Jim just starts laughing. He's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And Lorne said, what? He goes, do you know how many people Lorne puts on? He said, okay. All right. Well, then here's the deal.
Yeah.
You go back to Lorne. I'll write it down. You want me to write it down for you? Go back to Lorne and you tell him that Jim's fine with it. and you can do whatever you please. I'd love it if you're on camera or not. That's fine with me.
Yeah.
And then I left Jim's office, and I left Jim's office, and I looked at my boys, and I go, okay, now I'm out of here. Like, I've talked to Jim.
It?
Yeah, and I was like, I got to go. And then the weird thing is, and I talked to Townsend come by.
Robert
Townsend had come by, and he wanted to start this show out here. He was doing, and he kept calling it The Other Side of In Living Color, because at this point, he and Keenan had their big falling out. So, you know, he asked me about SNL and what it was like and how things worked. And I told him about that sort of back and forth. And he goes, dude, I'm going to use you as talent and a writer. I'm giving you what you want on my show. So I said, good. Love it.
And that's where you went?
I moved out here. Now that was a time when Abby was like, what? No. Like, it was like, wait, you're going to leave SNL, which is an established juggernaut, to go to Fox, because that was a deal. It was a Fox show when this was a point where Fox didn't even have a full day's worth of programming.
Right.
To work with Robert Townsend, who, you know, he had that Partners in Crime stuff, but, you know, he was not a proven entity. And everybody was against it. And I was like, yeah, but I think, you know, just creatively, this is going to work for me.
Got you out here.
Well, but there's this thing that was like, I'm still in that place. Like, I can write, but I'm a performer. That was always my thing. So Robert was feeling that he was hitting that note for me. But then what he would do is, like, he hired all these writers. Like, we had a nice little writer's room, and we'd turn in these sketches. And then we'd watch, the show was filmed, and we watched the show and then go, I don't recognize any of this. Did you write that?
Right.
No, I didn't. So sometimes you go, wait, I think this is my sketch because I wrote a sketch about a cafeteria. And here's a sketch that's in a restaurant. And I think that this is what became of my sketch. So Townsend did this thing where he would just rewrite everything.
Yeah.
Based on what he thought was best in the sketch, and it was not working. Then the weird thing was, I get this call from Fox executives. They say, come in. I go over, and they go, what do you think is working about the show? And I say, it's a great, the writer's amazing. It's a good group. I think, you know, whatever. I give them a whole long line list of things that are working. And they say, what do you think is not working? I go, I think you guys got to talk to Robert. And sometimes he's maybe a little in his own head. He's a little too much. And they say, I'm sorry. The question was posed is, what do you think would make the show work better? And I give them this whole thing. Like, you know, you got to do this. Number one thing, talk to Robert.
Yeah.
And they look at me and go, what else do you think would make the show work better? I go, oh, so you're not going to talk to Robert. Okay, I don't know. And they say, look, here's the thing. That show's not going to. We're getting rid of that show. But And then I think back in these days for Fox, it was like they're a new franchise.
Yeah.
So just cachet-wise, I'm a guy who wrote a couple years on SNL, and I work for Fox now.
Yeah.
They don't want me leaving
right.
the Fox farm team.
Right.
And so they're like, well, you know, we know that you have friends on In Living Color.
Yeah.
You know, I think you know some people over at Martin. We have this show called Living Single. So they throw those out at me. I couldn't resist. I'm like, did you just tell me the three black shows you have on your network?
Yeah.
Not take into account I just came here from SNL.
Right.
Oh, no, of course. You know, yeah, it became this whole thing. Like, oh, well, no, Married with Children would love you. We can set up a meeting. Sure. And I was like, nah, sorry, I get it. Just, you got to watch that. You know yeah. what I mean? That, and this is who I am. I mean, I shouldn't be talking about right, like that, yeah. but that's where I was. So, you know, I had my issues with those. I'm not trying to be part of a clique. So I'm like, well, I don't know anybody at Living Single. And of all of those shows, that one, you know, even Married with Children, like, there's a barrage of jokes. And the only new thing for me to learn is story. And yeah. story structure, and this Living Single thing seems to be more along those lines. And I go over there, and this woman, Yvette Lee, at the time, Yvette Denise Lee, now she's Yvette Bowser, but we had our meeting, and I also like the fact, like, you know, at this point, you know, New York, the comic, yeah. the, not so much the club owners and all yeah. that stuff, I'm getting really fed up
right.
with the lies and all this nonsense in the business. And I talked to her, and she says, well, you know, we started, like, we're on show number 6, and I used to have this guy here. Like, there's only one black male yeah. writer on the show. And so I said, honestly, are you hiring me? You're looking at me because I'm a funny guy, I'm a funny, talented guy who you think could fit in here? Or you're just talking to me because I'm another black guy, and you need another black guy? And she goes, this town is full of funny, talented writers. I'm talking to you because you're another black guy.
Wow.
She said, but a funny, talented black guy.
Right.
And I said, I got nothing but respect for that.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. You know, you could have, oh my God, you know, I've asked that question before, and I've gotten, oh my God, no, we totally respect. And I'm like, you know, just like my dad with the lies. Like, yeah. yeah. So there, and that was the thing. Like, I learned, and she's big on story structure. It's just like, I might not always like the stories or where they went, but right. as far as, like, setting them up, taking right. things to a different place, I'm like, okay, this is sitcom story structure. I'm learning something.
Yeah.
And there would be days I felt like, I mean, I was there almost to the last season, but the only reason I wasn't there last season is because I sold my own show to NBC. So I was like, I got to go because I got a show to do.
How many did they do?
Oh, how many?
Of your show.
How many did
what was that called?
It was called Built to Last.
Yeah.
How hard is that? First show canceled.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we did 8.
Uh-huh.
But they aired maybe 3.
Yeah. And so that was the first, like, you're like, now I'm in it. Fucking heartbreak.
Yes. Yes. Although when it was canceled, honestly, the day that they called to say we're done, you're canceled, I was on my way to New York. That I already knew that call was coming.
Yeah.
But I was leaving that day. I was yeah. only hanging around the offices.
Right.
Because I had to go to San Francisco to do my half hour comedy. So I was like, maybe this is what it was supposed
yeah,
to
yeah,
be.
Yeah,
right.
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna go do this half hour. And this
so
is
you're
over.
Always doing stand up.
Yeah, at that point, I still had my stand up. So I did Living Single almost until I got my own show. Until I sold that show.
Yeah.
I mean, I created that show. It was for Royale Watkins. I don't know if you.
Remember. I remember him. Okay. Is he all right?
He's good. He's good. Actually doing real good. He's got all kinds of stuff happening with Kevin
good.
Hart. He's doing
oh, good,
real good.
Good.
So, but I did his show, and then we got canceled. And part of the thing that made me crazy was like, okay, I got my own show on, but I wasn't a showrunner.
Yeah.
And so that was like, now that's the next thing. It's just like when I did comedy, it was like, okay, why didn't that work?
Yeah.
all right, now the variable is I got to be in charge of the vision.
Right.
So that I never really got the vision out with that. So now if I'm going to make this damn thing work, I got to be a showrunner.
Yeah.
All right. Then boom, what happens? Robert Townsend calls again because he had this show on Fox. Now it's called Apparently. He had a sitcom.
Yeah.
They need a showrunner. I talked to his partner. His partner and I had a better relationship. This woman who was like the partner in his company.
Yeah.
She's a genius. She wound up working at BET, still a genius, even though now we don't talk, but she's a genius.
What's her name?
Her name is Laretha Jones.
Okay.
And
this is for Parenthood?
Parenthood. So yeah. She's like, you know, we need a showrunner. So I go over there. So now I got showrunner credentials.
Okay.
And then I go from there. And then Moesha was like, hey, we need a showrunner. Can you come over here to help? And there I helped the woman who created the show.
Yeah.
And I even said, well, there's a lady there who created the show. Why do you need a showrunner? And they said, well, it used to be her and her, she was a partner.
Yeah.
Her and her partner created the show.
Right.
And now her partner's leaving to work on another show. And she's never run a show by herself.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, all right, that's so what you say. That. But then I do that, and then I see how the networks, how they undercut showrunners.
Uh-huh.
It's like, ooh. You know, I basically kind of watched them try to devalue, not even try to, they devalued her.
By just
they,
by bringing you in.
Well, bringing me, and then that was a thing. Like, first I had to make it clear to her, I'm not here to hurt you.
Yeah.
I'm honestly, if I can help, I'll help.
Right.
If you want me to shut up and get out of here and just make them happy because I'm here, I'll be that guy.
Yeah.
So she, and then the staff felt the same way. Like, who's this clown?
Right.
And the staff was intimidating. My thing was, I know I'm funny. Like, there's episodes of Living Single where I've 80% of the jokes, that's me. Story-wise, like I said, that's where I needed my help. At this place, you know, there's funny people, they got good jokes, and they know story. And I mean, I'm like, dude, there's a woman who I worked with who was a Harvard MBA. She's writing jokes on Moesha.
Yeah.
And then a guy who has got 2 degrees, he's got an English degree from Stanford and journalism from Columbia. He's working at Moesha.
Yeah.
And at the point where they fired the showrunner, and I'm the showrunner, now I'm their boss.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like a point where I'm like, what am I doing? I shouldn't be their boss. But then I was like, but you know what? They shouldn't be writing comedy. Fuck them. I'm better at the jokes. But so then I got that. And then if you talk to Moesha fans, I ruined the show. We don't have time for that. But then I left. Moesha was coming back. As we were told, Moesha was coming back.
Yeah.
And my agents were like, dude, you're going to be in this position. You're going to do this and that and other thing. And I said, I can't do this. This is crazy. This show and these people, I like Brandy. And I liked her mom. Her mom was getting vilified in the press. But she was cool to me, and I got what she was up to. But I was like, I can't. I got it. I need something else. And then Larry had called me, Larry Wilmore. We had a mutual friend.
Yeah.
And she said, Larry would like to talk to you. We met in Pasadena.
Yeah.
And at a Hooters. Which
right.
That's totally Larry. So we met there, and he told me about Bernie. He told me what he liked about it and everything. And so I called my agent. I said, I'm going to do this Bernie Mac thing. And it was like SNL all over for them. They were having flashbacks, I guess. They were like, But Moesha's coming back.
Right.
For a full season. That Bernie Mac thing is an experiment, and Fox might not do it. And I was like, let's do the Bernie Mac thing. And then Moesha got canceled. I had already made the jump, which I think Larry appreciated. I had made the jump.
He was a showrunner?
Yeah, he was a showrunner and the creator. And that was a deal. It was like, I had decided I'm going to be part of this thing before Moesha blew up. It was like, it wasn't like, oh, I can't go back to Moesha, so hey, dude, can I have that job? It was like, I want this job instead of that job.
And now, was working with Bernie good?
That was amazing. I feel like that was the best work I've ever done. And especially since part of my fed upness, and kind of even with Moesha, was like, okay, I learned sitcom story structure,
yeah,
but I'm sick of it. I'm like, how does anybody at home who watches sitcoms for 2 years not know where these stories are going? And then Bernie was like,
just a we don't know where these
we don't know where these stories. Yeah. This is great. We can go anywhere as long as we go somewhere funny and somewhere that's emotionally satisfying. It's like when we get to the end, if you look back through it emotionally, wherever Bernie was, of course it went that way.
Yeah.
As opposed to like structure wise, where we set this up and he said this and that happened, and you know,
he was driving it.
Oh, totally. And I love that. And that was all. And Larry was like, "Yeah, no, we're going to do it this way."
He was amazing. So Bernie was amazing.
Bernie was amazing. Like that the first 2 years of that show, that was like all amazement. And it was what I needed, because I got divorced on Moesha.
Yeah.
And then Bernie, and in the way I was living my life, like at Bernie was like it bought me back to life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and like I said, the first 2 years were amazing. It was the last 3 years, which honestly, the last 2 years is when I was running the show.
Yeah.
But paled in comparison.
You were there the whole time?
I was there from the pilot, no. But then from first episode to last episode, I was there.
Were you tight with him?
Bernie?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I love Bernie. I'm sorry. I did actually listen to John, because somebody told me John mentioned me. Like the people that I came out, the people that I feel the best about meeting in L.A., John, when John and I were working together, John Ridley.
I love him.
Is a, you know, I mean, I feel like, first of all, I have defended John so many times to so many people, because I really feel like he's like my little brother. Just age-wise, he's younger than us. But he's been so in your face about things.
Yeah.
And people are like, what's up with that fucking John Ridley? And I go, you know, hold on a second. Hold on, man. Hold on. Hold on.
Yeah.
John's got a point.
Yeah.
We don't have to agree with him. Right. You know, but he's got a point, you know. Like, he was not a big fan of going on strike. So all the people were like, this fucking guy.
Yeah.
But.
Him and Bernie were the guys?
John, Bernie, and Larry.
Yeah.
I mean, Larry, I felt like John was as close to a brother as I'm going to get. Larry was the best mentor ever. And still is. And I'm like, Larry's like that kind of guy. Like, he's like that professor that I go, did you like that dissertation? Am I good? Is that anywhere close to what you were trying to teach me?
Yeah.
You know, and he's also the kind of, Larry's definitely the kind of guy who does not suffer fools gladly. And I'm like, but I'm a fool. I'm kind of foolish.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bernie, just for a guy from the, Bernie actually reminds me of my Uncle Everett, although I doubt he's ever had any live grenade. But just full blown about life. That's it. The thing is, now I'm taking care of my kids.
I
we couldn't get into it, but you know, I think you can get some of my thing is like to be a good dad.
Yeah.
And so with my kids, I'm doing this whole thing like I'm family first.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be a good dad. And by my standards, not somebody else's fucking standards.
Right.
But this is what I decide a good dad is. And, but then there's those times when I go, I think I'm using that as an excuse. I can be a good dad and a creative person and be out here and show the world who I am and maybe even get some respect, because my daughter could care less about me. But I love her so much. It's one story about my daughter, because Father's Day was just gone, and she's going to like this little summer camp / summer school thing, and so they got black cardboard, black construction paper, they splatter white paint on it.
Yeah,
it's gonna be the stars. They put this paste a rocket ship, and then a little picture of her.
Yeah,
and then on the side that the teachers had written, you know, I love you to the moon and back, Happy Father's Day.
Yeah.
So she does hers, love you to the moon and back, Happy Father's Day. And then she writes over in the corner, but not really. right? And I say that, and she says, I wrote not really.
Yeah.
But it's like she doesn't want to be fake.
And so she goes, I go to her, I look at it. She says, I had to write, not really. I said, because you don't really feel this way, right? I said, you don't know that expression, love you to the moon and back. She's right. Like, yeah, I don't know. I said, well, here's the thing, though. Like, just tell me this.
Yeah.
Because I'm not my grandmother. I'm not beating her ass
right.
because she's not fitting in.
Yeah.
I'm me. And I want to learn who my kids are. Yeah. And I want them to be who they are. And I'm just going to guide them when they need guidance. I said, how far do you love me? Just, you know, yeah. it doesn't have to be to the moon and back. And we're standing. We just came in the house. And she showed me the thing. And she goes, oh, okay. And she looks around. And she says, okay, maybe from here, from where we are in the foyer. And she walks to, like, the far end of the living room.
Yeah.
She looks out the window. She says, probably from over there where I was to, like, the back of that house. And I'm like, okay. And I'm saying,
that's something.
That's you doing you.
Yeah.
Which is what I'm like, that's what I got to allow myself to do.
Right.
This is like the moon and back. Who? Every fucking body in the classroom said that.
Yeah, without even knowing what it means.
Exactly. But yeah. from this foyer to that house across the back of that house yeah. across the street, that's me and you, baby.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
So I'm all about that. And I got a couple projects that I'm working on, but I was like, I'm feeling like I got to wrap that up and then I got to start doing me again because I can't just go away, even though I feel like I've gone away.
Well, I feel like you're back.
Thank you, Mark.
And it was nice talking to you, buddy.
Yeah, it's good talking to you.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much.
There you go. That was Warren Hutcherson, a guy I started out with. Very funny guy. His life in show business and his life in life. The book, our book, Waiting for the Punch, can be pre-ordered at WTFpod.com and at MarkMaronBook.com. I've been emailing all the people in the book about them getting the book. Obviously, I'm going to send them a book, but it's very nice that everybody's getting back to me. Makes me feel like people like me. All right. I'm just going to play some unprepared guitar with no effects. That seems people seem to enjoy it, but I got to... People. The two guys that emailed. It's just a strat into the Dirty Old Man. 58 Deluxe, kind of cranked. Boomer lives.